Welcome to the Kindling's Muse podcast.
Hi, this is Dick Staub with another in our Journeys series, conversations with thoughtful creatives and cultural influencers on their life, work, and personal journey. And now we continue our conversation with the late Art Buchwald. Well, this is Dick Staub back with you. Art Buchwald is my guest. His book is "I'll Always Have Paris." The photograph on the cover. Did you actually go over to Paris and leap around?
No, that was taken in '61 by a guy named Doug Kirkland for Look magazine. It was a spread they did on Look, and then the inside cover there. That's Doug's picture too, which is a wonderful picture of me taking my kids to school. And my daughter, she's way ahead of the. And she was very upset with that photo when I explained to her, Jenny, you've always been leading us ever since.
Oh, it's a great shot of a dad with three kids. You had, in this book, you had the chance to finally get some stuff off of your chest, both about positive experiences you had, but some aggravating ones. And you have a number of stories of Americans who expected you to be at their beck and call, simply because you were in Paris, you were an American, and they would ask of you the most bizarre things.
Well, there's a couple. One had to do with a lady who came in and said, you went to USC, didn't you? And I said, yes. She said, I want you to help me do something. I said, what? She said, I want you to hang a banner on the Arc de Triomphe. I said, what does the banner say? He said, beat Stanford. And I said, wait a minute. The Arc de Triomphe is the tomb of the unknown soldiers. She says, no guts, huh? But the other one was a good story because a guy wrote to me, Harvey Brodsky, and he said that he was in love with a girl named Gloria Siegel, and if he could get Picasso's autograph, then he'd get back with her. So I wrote his letter. I printed his letter, and Picasso read it, or David Duncan read it to Picasso. Picasso drew a beautiful flowers and said, poor Gloria Siegel. And David Duncan called me up and says, I got it. I got the picture for Gloria Siegel. I said, nuts to Gloria Siegel. What about me? And so Picasso sat down, and he drew a picture of he and I having a drink together, which I cherish now.
Wow. And you tell the story of him being involved in a march and you out there supporting him and cheering for him.
Yeah.
Not because you agreed with him ideologically, because it raises the
picture.
Yeah, you had a picture. Why not?
I thought the value of the picture would go up if I cheered Picasso. He was walking down the Champs-Élysées in a communist demonstration. Picasso was a communist.
Yeah. There were so many stories like that. Somerset Maugham got a valuable painting on the door of
Somerset Maugham, the writer, wonderful writer of Human Bondage. He had a beautiful painting on the Cezanne.
No, Gauguin.
Gauguin.
Yeah.
On the wall, and it was in wood. I said, where'd you get that? And he said, when I was in Tahiti, I asked to see Gauguin's house. And I went there, and there was this painting on the door. And I said to the man who owned the house, I said, that's a nice door you got there. I'd like to buy it. He says, you can't. He says, why not? He says, where would I get a door? So Mom says, I'll make you a door. So Mom had a guy make him a door, and the guy sold him this painting for about $40 or something. It's gorgeous.
Amazing. This is what's so wonderful about this memoir, is that you're telling the stories, first-hand accounts of these people that most of us read about, and these are first-hand encounters. I mean, you've met so many interesting, fascinating people.
You know, one of the things that's very interesting is people come up and they ask me to sign it, but they don't want to read my book. They want to tell me their story about their days in Paris.
Really?
I had a love affair there. I had the greatest meal of my life there. Everyone has a Paris story, and this is the nostalgia for them.
What is the magic of Paris when you think about it now? You talk at the end of the book about you and Anne, and she loved the smells, and you loved the noises, and there was all of that and
more. It's a city of love. We criticize the French, but it is a city of love. First of all, it's probably one of the most beautiful cities in the world. And thank heavens that the Germans didn't destroy it the way they were supposed to. The architecture there, it was built by kings. Everything there that was any good was built by the kings. If the common people built it, it would look like London.
Now, there's the kind of thing that Art says in his columns that gets him in trouble. If the common people want to build Paris, it would have looked like London. And now the letters will start pouring in from London. That's the story of your career.
Well, we all have memories of Paris because, first of all, the sidewalk cafes are romantic. You remember stories about that. You remember, so, you know, I don't know if you want to know this, but I used to pick up girls in the Louvre.
Yeah.
And what I do is I go to the Louvre and I see a girl by herself and we'd be looking at the same painting. Let's say it was a Renoir. I'd say, you know, Renoir died of a kidney stone or he would have kept going. And if she laughed, we could have a cup of coffee.
Yeah, you'll find famous pickup lines for the Louvre in this book, too. There's a little bit of something for everybody.
And then the six-minute Louvre. You know, there are only three things worth seeing in the Louvre. That's the Venus de Milo, the Winged Victory, and the Mona Lisa.
Yeah.
And for years, tourists have been trying to get through to see those three things and go shopping again. Before the war, the record was 6 minutes and 15 seconds. And after war, a friend of mine, Peter Stone, did it in 5 minutes and 12 seconds. And that record still stands if anybody wants to beat it.
Well, I have to confess that my first time in Paris, I had a limited amount of time. And somebody had given me the suggestion that you know identify just a few key works of art.
Yeah.
And like probably a lot of other tourists, I ran in, saw the Mona Lisa, the few other famous paintings, and then left. Later on, I did get time to go back. You told an interesting story about your involvement with archaeology in Israel in this book. That was fascinating.
The army went to me. I was visiting there. I was a newspaper man. They offered me anything I wanted. I said, I'd like to go down to the Dead Sea and see the caves where they were digging for Dead Sea Scrolls. They flew me down there. Professor Yardin had an expedition going in the caves across from Masada. Nobody had been in these caves. And they were looking for stuff, and the night before they made a discovery. There was a lot of bat dung, about 10 feet of bat dung, but they found it anyway. It was all laid out on top of the mountain. I had a helicopter. So Professor Yardin asked me if I would take all the stuff back to Tel Aviv with me in the helicopter. So I agreed. So there's a picture in his book of me carrying it in a Campbell's soup can back to Tel Aviv. And I said, not only to give me a chance to play a small part in a great archaeological discovery, but it gave me something to read on the plane.
You made the decision to go home after 14 years.
Yeah.
Why? What was it that...
I had sort of exhausted all the things I was doing. I kept repeating myself because I was making fun of the French, the English, the British, the ugly American. And I came home and Kennedy was in the White House and I decided I need a new... And I didn't want to become an expatriate. Can I tell you about the Warsaw story, which is funny, the horse story?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, well, one of the highlights of my trip is I went to Warsaw, and I said, what do you do? And they sent me to the racetrack, and everybody's betting 4,000 people. Then the bell rings. They go to the rail, no horses, and they point to the winners, 3, 6, 5. I don't know what the heck's going on. I finally say to a guy, hey, where are the horses? He says, they're in Krakow. I says, oh? He says, we have only one string, 1 week in Krakow, 1 week in Warsaw. I says, okay, I understand that, but why do they go to the rail? He says, where would you go?
It's a classic story. You can see I even highlighted that story in the book.
Yeah.
Folks, there are more fun anecdotes and more lessons to be learned per page in this book than you're going to find almost anywhere in the book, I'll Always Have Paris. You did get to go back to Paris with Anne for the 1987, was it the 100th celebration?
It was the 100th anniversary of the Herald Tribune. I was the last of the Mohicans because everyone else was gone. And we went to the Eiffel Tower. Underneath the Eiffel Tower, they built a building for the dinner. It was 1,400 people. And they brought out 99 candles, and they say, everybody blow. We all blew, and the 99 candles went out. And then they blew the 100th candle, and the Eiffel Tower went out.
It's an unbelievable story. One of the things that we haven't gotten into in our discussion this afternoon has to do with your dealing with depression in your life, which is an important part of the story, really.
Yeah, well, we don't have time to go into it, but all I can tell you, if you're depressed or going to get depressed or were depressed, don't do anything stupid because you come out of it a better person, I'm a better writer because of my depression. I'm a better person, and I don't think I could have written Leaving Home or I'll Always Have Paris if I hadn't had my depression, which got rid of so many monkeys on my back.
Interesting. The book is I'll Always Have Paris. And you say this is the last memoir. You're not going to cover your Washington
years. No, I'm doing a novel now.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you give us a hint of where it's going? Or?
Oh, it's about a widower.
About, oh. It's a novel about a widower. That'll be fascinating.
This concludes our conversation with the late Art Buchwald. Thank you for listening to Journeys on the Kindling's Muse.